Ladies and gentlemen, as I came this evening, it occurred to me that this was the ninth lecture for our fall term series of lectures. We have two more, and next term we're going to have another 10, so that we have 21 lectures during the season. And with that thought in mind, I then thought I had to make my usual speech about the benefits of becoming a member of the Vancouver Institute. If you do a bit of simple mathematics division, you will see that for 21 lectures you can get a family membership for $15 and a single membership for $10. And this sounds like a bargain. Now, when you came in, you would have seen in the corridor a table with people selling memberships. And as you go, I hope that you will stop there if you haven't stopped there already, assuming you are not presently a long-standing member. In addition to being able to come to these lectures and get a seat in this side of the line, the corridor, we will send you, if you become a member soon, we will send you a list of the program for the series of lectures in the post-Christmas period. And I can assure you that Mrs. Nemetz, the program chairman, has lined up a very impressive list of speakers for the post-Christmas series. So please bear that in mind. Now, this evening, we shall have the pleasure of hearing Dr. Kevin Cahill, and he's one of those American medical scientists whose accomplishments are so numerous that they leave us with a state of amazement. He is a graduate of Fordham University and then of Cornell University Medical School. He has become an outstanding expert on tropical and infectious diseases. His present position is he's clinical professor of public health and preventative medicine at New Jersey College of Medicine. And he also is the director of the Tropical Disease Center at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York. He combines with this academic career and the director of this center a very active clinical practice of medicine. He also has a distinguished public service record. He served as a special assistant to the New York Governor Hugh Carey. He served as the chairman of the Health Planning Commission of New York State. He has had responsibilities in the third world countries, especially in Africa, and he has acted as advisor to the Catholic Medical Mission Board. His list of publications, simply amazing too. Some 14 books I saw on the list and about 165 articles, I think it was, which to an academic lawyer at any rate seems a rather enormous number. Amid all of these various activities, he has taken time to come to Vancouver to lecture to our students and to lecture to us here this evening. He has a special interest in this baffling new disease which goes under the name of AIDS, and that is going to be his subject to us this evening. The precise terms of the address is AIDS, a medical and social problem. Gives me pleasure to call on Dr. Cahill to address us.
you very much, Dr. Bourne. I don't know about tonight, but it certainly sounds like the greatest bargain for $10 I've ever heard. You wouldn't get that in New York. In preparing for tonight's talk, I had been in contact with Dr. Dirks, and I spent a great deal of time writing this talk. And then Dr. Dirks had the idea that for an audience that may not have seen or heard or be clear about AIDS, it might be worthwhile having some slides. And I tried my best to incorporate them in the talk, but it didn't work. So what I'd like to do is deliver the talk that I wrote. We'll go over some slides, and then I'll be happy to answer any questions. For the past few days, I've had the opportunity to discuss the clinical and therapeutic aspects of AIDS with physicians at St. Paul's Hospital and at the Vancouver General Hospital. Tonight, in addressing a largely lay audience on a medical epidemic, I shall focus on some of the social and philosophic issues that have been raised, at least for me, by the AIDS experience. I'd like to begin with a story whose relevance to the topic at hand may not be immediately evident, but please bear with me. It's the story, which some of you may know, about the government scientists who were conducting an experiment on frogs and their ability to leap great distances. First, they trained the frog to leap on their command jump, and they took the measurements of the distance covered. Next, they cut off one of the frog's legs, gave it the command jump, and again they measured the result. Then a second leg was cut off, and a third, followed each time by the command jump and a measurement of the distance covered. Finally, they amputated the frog's fourth leg, but when they gave it the command jump, nothing happened. It just sat there staring ahead. The scientists went back to their office and wrote their report. Its conclusion was that cutting off all four legs of a frog makes it go deaf. Reduced to its simplest terms, that is, I suppose, a story about cause and effect, or more precisely, about the kind of absurdity, or at least inappropriate reaction, that can result in medicine as well as in laboratory experiments when people substitute subjective opinion for the evidence at hand. That lesson, sadly, was part of what we learned as the AIDS epidemic evolved. Reactions and hypotheses and even conclusions usually reflected more on the mores and fears of the instant authorities who emerged almost daily than on the few facts that were available. At one end of the spectrum, there were those all too ready to see the disease as a punishment from on high. To this group, the cause was clear: the homosexual lifestyle of the victims. The effect, a pestilence brought on by the wrath of God, was justified, even if it was, in their view, a bit late coming on. At the other extreme were gay activists, some of whom saw the disease as an opportunity to advocate what were essentially social and political, not medical, gains for the homosexual community. A few even suggested that the cause of this epidemic was man-made, that someone or some group was waging chemical or biological warfare against gays. Government's reaction to the epidemic was also puzzling, especially at first. Epidemics of the recent past had triggered immediate, huge responses on the part of the federal government in the United States. The homosexual claimed, with some justification, that the response to the AIDS epidemic was sluggish in the extreme and influenced adversely by the sexual mores of the victims. When government did respond, it did so, in part at least, inappropriately. Both the city and the state governments in New York set up offices of gay and lesbian health, thereby exhibiting, it seems to me, a serious confusion of medical and social problems, and establishing a precedent that, logically pursued, would lead to the proliferation of health offices, each devoted to the concerns of a narrowly defined population. Early in the epidemic, four groups were identified as being particularly susceptible to AIDS: homosexual men, intravenous drug abusers, hemophiliacs, and Haitians. The inclusion of Haitians among the at-risk groups set off another reaction, in which there seemed little relationship between cause and effect. Some Haitians claim that their inclusion was racially motivated. While there is no evidence to support that charge, the Haitian community at large did suffer from their identification as an at-risk group. Haitian children were taunted at school, and Haitian workers, especially those employed as domestic help, found their jobs threatened because of the fear, completely unsubstantiated, that they might carry and transmit AIDS. This epidemic, then, was wrapped from the beginning in layers of confusion and twisted logic. Like the scientists in the frog story, people seemed to draw from the facts whatever conclusions fitted their convenience or purposes. Having begun with those thoughts, let's look now at some of the terrible facts of the AIDS epidemic. Several years ago, healthy young men began to die in large numbers from an unknown disease. As so often happens in the history of medicine, the early cases were considered isolated extremes in the normal spectrum of any illness, and there was, in retrospect, an inadequate appreciation by the health professions of a growing disaster. Slowly but inexorably, the numbers afflicted grew until this insidious disease exploded into a frightening epidemic. Persons who had been previously well developed rare tumors and unusual systemic infections. Studies indicated that these patients had suddenly and inexplicably lost their normal immunity to disease. They had an illness for which modern medicine had no name, and in our ignorance, we called it acquired immune deficiency syndrome, or AIDS. Many years ago, an Irish poet captured in rhyme the chaos that follows the destruction in a human of something so basic as our protective immunologic system. The poet's words seem applicable as well to the social stresses that flowed from our fear of the unknown. In The Second Coming, Yeats wrote, "Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity." More and more cases have been recognized since AIDS was first seen in 1979 and 1980. At first, all the victims were homosexual men in New York City and California. But soon, heterosexual Haitians and drug addicts were diagnosed. Then blood recipients, particularly hemophiliacs, fell before this new puzzling and deadly epidemic. Within 18 months, over 1,000 cases were reported in the United States and Europe, and the numbers have steadily doubled every 6 months. By October of 1983, the United States Center for Disease Control had verified over 2,300 cases in 38 states. AIDS has been documented overseas from Scandinavia to Japan, A few weeks ago, I was teaching in Ireland, and physicians there almost proudly told me they had diagnosed the first case in Dublin. One local doctor tried to explain away any implications the case may have held for the Irish culture, however, by observing somewhat wryly, "Ah, but he's a Protestant." As the epidemic spread, there were many questions and few answers. Concern led to fear and mushroomed into panic. There were demands for drastic action, but no one was quite certain what to do. United States federal officials seemed to approach this epidemic with embarrassment, declaring that the problem was a local issue. Local authorities claimed they could do little without federal support. Words and endless meetings became a substitute for rational action. Politicians handled the epidemic with unaccustomed wariness. Almost without exception, public leaders evaded the epidemic, avoiding even the usual expressions of compassion and concern. It was as if the sexual orientation of the victims made any involvement risky, and the politicians directed their courage and energies elsewhere. 7 months ago, I had the privilege of chairing a major symposium on AIDS in New York. Colleagues, including the directors of the United States Center for Disease Control and of our National Institutes of Health, the presidents of the Infectious Disease Society of America, and of the American Blood Bank Association, concerned health commissioners and fellow clinicians gathered to detail the then-known facts on AIDS. Despite an unusually close relationship with a fair number of senior senators and congressmen, I could not entice one of them to even identify with our impeccable scientific session. A single act, the compassionate deed of a saintly man, crumbled that shameful wall of official reticence. I approached Terence Cardinal Cook, the late Archbishop of New York, and told him how the politicians were avoiding involvement, possibly because of a fear that the church figures might be critical of any support for the homosexual community. His Eminence immediately responded by offering to open the symposium himself, and from that moment on, the politicians issued endless pronouncements, and the media dramatized the epidemic almost to a point that we longed for the quiet and lonely days of a year earlier. Still, the young men continued to die. In New York City alone, we have had over 1,000 cases with an 80% mortality in those patients diagnosed 2 years ago. But even as the disaster escalated, the organized medical community was strangely absent. When a fatal infection had struck down veterans attending an American Legion convention, health professionals across the country joined in a search for a solution. When women using tampons became ill with toxic shock syndrome, medical societies and research centers immediately focused their enormous talents on that problem. But when the victims were drug addicts and poor Haitian refugees and homosexual men, their plight did not somehow seem as significant to those expected to speak for the health professions. No major research programs were announced at first, and until it became clear that the disease could spread to the general population through blood transfusions, organized medicine seemed part of the curious conspiracy of silence. Nevertheless, when historians reflect on this epidemic years hence, I suspect they will not stress the sordid stories of failure and neglect, but rather recount the remarkable tales of heroism that illuminate this dark, lonely period of struggle to unravel the unknown. While government and organized medicine appeared to look for excuses for inaction, A new collective will was building among those most at risk of contracting AIDS. Their greatest strength lay in a determination not to be destroyed, in a common conviction that demanded public attention be paid to this epidemic, and in an unprecedented willingness to help those who needed the medical, psychological, and social assistance that society had not offered. Out of such determination was formed the Gay Men's Health Crisis and other groups that have done superb work educating, advising, and sustaining frightened, vulnerable people with nowhere else to turn. No one has captured better than Albert Camus the unique exile an epidemic imposes. In The Plague, he wrote, and I quote, "There was always something missing in their lives, hostile to the past, impatient of the present, and cheated of the future. They were much like those whom men's justice or hatred forces to live behind prison bars. The plague had swallowed up everything and everyone. No longer were there individual destinies, only a collective destiny made of plague and the emotion shared by all. Strongest of these emotions was the sense of exile and of deprivation, with all the cross currents of revolt and fear set up by these. All too often, the victims of AIDS have been made to feel like Camus' victims, exiled and deprived of the full measure of what modern medicine can offer. But there have also been many instances of individual courage, of simple adherence by physicians and nurses and technicians to a code as old as medicine itself. These will never be recorded or acknowledged individually. Clinical medicine is not built on heroic deeds or memorable feats, but on steady, loyal service to patients. When those patients are dying in large numbers, and when the mode of transmission of their disease is unknown, then the daily routine of involved health workers assumes a quiet dignity and decency that deserves respect. The clinician has an unusual role in an epidemic, for he shares the victim's sufferings, their despair, and their dwindling hopes. In this epidemic, physicians have had to face daily patients in the prime of their life who are suffering from a disease we do not understand and cannot cure. We have often had to sustain them solely with the ancient commitment of our profession to remain at the post, seeking answers and offering help until this plague has been conquered. There is usually nothing dramatic in service except in retrospect." Camus' fictional physician, Dr. Rieu, had noted in the midst of their epidemic, and again I quote, "his inability to record at this point something of a really spectacular order, some heroic feat or memorable deed like those that thrill us in the chronicles of the past. The truth is that nothing is less sensational than pestilence. And by reason of their very duration, great misfortunes are monotonous. In the memories of those who lived through them, the grim days of plague do not stand out like vivid flames, ravenous and inextinguishable, beaconing a troubled sky, but rather like the slow, deliberate progress of some monstrous thing crushing out all in its path." Even if we, as physicians, are incapable, at least for a time, of altering the inexorable progress of an epidemic, we have nonetheless a very privileged position from which to view the vagaries of man. Is that privilege appreciated and utilized? Too often the answer must be no. For too long, medical professionals have spoken only to one another, documenting the toll of disease, studying its causes and victims, calling upon anyone and everyone to listen to their advice. They have failed, however, to move beyond the traditional limitations of the profession, failed to realize that merely convincing, or is it conversing with one another, has neither altered economic policies nor significantly influenced political will, and it is in these areas that the critical decisions which determine the extent or even existence of health programs are made most frequently. Too rarely have competent, respected health experts been willing to venture into the turbulent councils where government priorities are established and financial allocations are set. Those best qualified have made too small a contribution to these councils in regard to the human resource, the human potential, and the impact of programs on people. If there has been a sense of outrage at the human condition, whether in the AIDS epidemic or in any other disaster, those who should be able to express this have either been unable or unwilling to articulate the harsh realities of sickness in comprehensible terms which can alter the opinions and actions of decision makers. For too long, we who deal with and know most intimately the one unique resource, the human being, have allowed our projects to remain dreams and our priorities to be but words. If professionals in science and health continue merely to rail against the system and absent themselves from the political process, they should not have and probably do not deserve the power to fashion our society. In accepting the invitation to be with you tonight, I did so because of the challenge it offered, to reflect upon some social and philosophic aspects of the AIDS experience before an audience that I was assured was the policy-making body in a city that I had come to admire. The AIDS experience provides, I would suggest, an unusual opportunity for perspective as well as a chance to rekindle the spirit of a community. This is not the worst disaster. I've had the unusual good fortune of working in places that range from Somali refugee camps where over a million mothers and children were starving, and I once was in charge of medical services in Nicaragua following an earthquake where 20,000 people died in a night. I've run clinics while bombs fell on our building in West Beirut last year. Some perspective is needed as we deal with the AIDS epidemic. Each generation deludes itself by thinking that the demands imposed on it are more rigorous than what its predecessors had to bear, that the problems are more insoluble now than then, that it is suffering a complexity in human life never before encountered, that far more is expected of its members than was of those before them, and speakers often encourage this delusion by sending their listeners off with the charge to resolve the problems that their fathers created. All of this somehow does not ring true to experience. It denies the continuity of human life. It is too naive a view of the world. People have always needed to struggle. Right never triumphs spontaneously over wrong. Integrity has always been maintained only through acts of courage. Compassion has never been worth a damn unless it manifested itself in concrete acts of love. And our day is no different. Only the morally blind can miss the symbols of sacrifice in our world. They're everywhere. On a wall in Belfast, Northern Ireland, where I was several weeks ago, where a child had scratched the desperate question, is there a life before death? In the hollow eye sockets and the mocking bellies of those dying from malnutrition in Bangladesh and Africa and Latin America, and surely in the hopeless faces of AIDS patients who appear increasingly like Auschwitz prisoners as they inexorably approach death. We must not allow ourselves to become so well insulated by distance and by our own good fortune that we never feel the chill reality of others' sufferings. We must not allow the facts of hunger and poverty, of disease and political despotism to remain merely statistics, and forget that it is people, not numbers, that get sick and are starving or oppressed. We must not merely talk about the problems and deceive ourselves that words or even concern are a substitute for corrective actions and deeds of compassion. It may seem that I have wandered far from AIDS, but it is essential for us to realize that the care of the AIDS patient has been and is influenced by forces that have nothing to do with immunology or chemotherapy. He is the beneficiary or the victim of all our views on illness and life, of the priorities we set in allocating public funds, and of the perspective that both past experiences and future dreams impose on our society. For added to the medical challenge of AIDS has been a growing crisis in hospital and social service departments. Because of the need for isolation precautions, every facet of their care, from nursing and nutrition to laboratory work and housekeeping, becomes extremely costly. The duration of an AIDS hospital stay is usually measured in months, and hospital bills in excess of $200,000 occur with regularity. Health insurance coverage for the young and the poor, who constitute the majority of AIDS victims, is usually inadequate, often non-existent in the United States. Society had not planned well for this epidemic. The history of medicine, nevertheless, again reassures us that with time and effort, the terrible mystery of AIDS will be unraveled and a cure found. When that day comes, we may look back and reflect with the same satisfaction that Camus' character, Dr. Riou, experienced as his epidemic finally vanished from Oran, and again I quote him, "And it was in the midst of shouts rolling against the terrace wall and massive waves that waxed in volume and duration, while cataracts of colored fire fell thicker through the darkness, that Dr. Riou resolved to compile this chronicle so that he should not be one of those who held their peace, but should bear witness in favor of those plague-stricken people, so that some memorial of the injustice and outrage done to them might endure, and to state quite simply what we learn in times of pestilence, that there are more things to admire in men than to despise." Thank you very much. I think that's it. Okay. No, I think they said 1 and 3. I think if I could, I'll just go over some slides with you so that those who are not familiar with AIDS in the audience will appreciate from this brief survey a visual presentation, at least of the definition and the epidemiology of slides. As I mentioned, in the past few days, I've had the opportunity to share with colleagues at the St. Paul's and Vancouver General Hospital clinical details. I didn't think that was appropriate for tonight, and so I'm just going to go through these, basically telling you that this is a new disease. There's no question about that in the minds of us who at least work in New York, where the majority of cases have been. And this can be documented from autopsy studies. At least it hasn't occurred in the last 50 years. And it's a very, very different condition because diseases such as pneumocystis pneumonia or Kaposi sarcoma are easily recognizable diseases. And they would have appeared either in autopsy or clinical studies, and they just hadn't. And So it's in patients who have no other known cause. If they're getting chemotherapy for cancer, then it's an easy thing to say that's why their problem is. But these were mostly young people. My own series of patients is about 40 patients or so, a little more than that now. The average age is about 35. And those that have lived, I have none living 3 years. Most are dead in between the second and third year. This takes you only to last April, but the curve hasn't changed at all since the first cases were described in the early period of 1980, first in New York and California, as I mentioned. The incidence has risen very, very dramatically and continues to rise. And as those of you who follow the literature will know, there is an incubation period. At least we know it to be at least 18 months, and indeed maybe longer, and so that even though major changes in lifestyle have probably reduced the exposure rate, the numbers of cases over the next year or so would very likely be expected to continue that type of curve. This again shows you the cases as of last April, but nothing has changed very much except it has been recognized as physicians become more aware of the condition, as patients seek medical care earlier. The cases are now, as I mentioned, seen or have been diagnosed in 38 states and increasingly around the world, but the great bulk of the cases are in the areas of New York and California. I was at Vancouver General Hospital yesterday, and in a series of cases that were presented in the tropical medicine clinic, they had a travel history, and it was an AIDS patient, and the important thing was he hadn't traveled to New York. I mean, we always thought about traveling to New Delhi or something as important, but now New York becomes the big place that you have to know not to travel to. In New York, I show you again that type of curve that was expressed in the national curve earlier, but the rise is very dramatic indeed. And I put up there, as of September, when we had a little over 2,000 cases, and now, as I say, it's over 2,300, probably 2,400 at this time, the percentages are roughly what you see. It's a little higher, maybe 72% as of the last figure in the homosexual community, 16 or 17% in the drug addicts, and then a smaller percentage in the other groups, with possibly the answer lying in the very small percentage where all risk absent will be studied. Dr. Dirks and I've had discussions over the last few days of the opportunity that AIDS may offer to people studying other immunological deficiencies, and the benefits from the research that is currently going on may indeed have implications for other diseases in the future, and it's something that shouldn't be forgotten as we go forward with allocations and try to address the problem in this instance of a specific disease, but knowledge will not be limited to that. This is maybe a bit too technical for the non-medical audience, but the point is that there is a fundamental breakdown in the immunologic system which can be measured in different ways. People fail to respond to skin tests. They have various laboratory studies where we have helper cells that are depressed, and you have more suppressor cells that emerge, and so that we have ways of measuring a person's immunological deficiency. What we do not have, since this is a syndrome and not a specific disease, we do not have a specific diagnostic test. We don't really even have a good predictive test at this time, and very often we just have to confirm to the patient their present level of health, urge them to stay under medical care, and really our role as physicians right now is to try to take care of the complications of AIDS in the hope that a person will live long enough so that the fundamental defect, the immunological deficiency, can be reversed while they're alive. This is a list of the various infections that are very, very common in patients with AIDS. And while some of them may seem minor, for example, candida or the cause of thrush in a mouth would be known to many people, but in the AIDS patient, this becomes an overwhelming problem. He develops a type of caking or coating of his entire mouth and esophagus going down, and they can literally choke to death from that. Toxoplasma is a very common disease in society. The women in the audience may know it as a cause of fetal abnormalities if you acquire this infection during pregnancy. But if you do surveys, you find many, many people have it. Toxoplasmosis in the AIDS patient is not a subtle infection. It's not something that presents with swollen lymph nodes or even eye problems. It presents with, as we'll see, catastrophic brain abscesses. And the sadness of a lot of the viral infections on the left-hand side in the beginning is that we don't have adequate treatment for most of those. They also develop a number of different tumors, and I'll show just a slide of Kaposi's sarcoma, which is the one that one problem. It's a very visible, easily diagnosed, and very unusual problem in medicine, and therefore we focus on it. But as observations have continued, more and more of the tumors are being recognized, particularly central nervous system lymphomas. And this somewhat risky slide, because it implies something that I'm not even certain of myself, that those patients with lymphadenopathy are inevitably narrowing down. And that's a longer story than we can get into tonight. But as with all diseases, there is a large population base, and then some, for reasons we don't know, seem to go on to develop the more serious complications. This slide was made up by a colleague of mine, Dr. Bijan Safai, who's a great dermatologist, and he dignifies Kaposi's sarcoma at the top of the pyramid. I'd put opportunistic infections, which is the OI, so it depends where you start, because they die of infection more commonly. I'm not going to show any clinical slides tonight, with two exceptions, and that was, I thought it might be for an after-dinner talk, present all right to show you an x-ray, and certainly if you look at that x-ray, anyone can tell it's a very abnormal x-ray. And this is the most common cause of death in the AIDS patient. It's a condition called pneumocystis carinii. It's a parasite, and that's how I got involved in the AIDS thing, because I deal with parasitic diseases, and therefore patients began to be sent in to me. This is a parasite that wasn't even known until the late 1930s. The first case was not even seen in the United States till 1954. And to give you one idea, in my hospital, there were two cases in the last decade, and there have been something like 46 cases in the last 6 months. So it's a very different picture that we're seeing in New York today, and likely that people will see all over the place. The treatment, another way of measuring that rapid rise in cases, is that the drug of choice for this, or one of the drugs used, is a drug that must be obtained in our country from the Federal Center for Disease Control, and that just gives you the number of requests. And as you can see, starting in 1981, the curve took off, and it just continues to climb. Very often, as we're seeing more and more cases, and we struggle with conditions such as pneumocystis, where we do have a treatment for it, and they may, if you get to them early enough, respond to the treatment. They may come down with the problem again. But what we're finding is that we're getting through the treatable phase almost, and we're getting into the untreatable. And a disease such as cytomegalic virus shows the type of problem that we're facing more and more, that 5 out of 8 patients recently treated in my series were dead within 8 months. and we don't have a good. There are certain drugs that are available. They're all very, very dangerous because the patients already have a tremendously compromised immune system, and the drugs make it worse. And so that CMV, which was a is cytomegalic virus, a condition that we all knew about, suddenly becomes the fatal condition when pneumocystis, which we had perceived to be the terrible thing, were able at least to do something about it. I think I was going to show three slides out of clinical. This is one to show what cytomegalic virus can do in these patients and why this condition is not something that can almost be captured, and Dr. Dirks was correct, not just in words. It's to see a slide. This is the eye of a playwright, a patient of mine who started getting blurry vision on a Friday, was totally blind by Monday, and that's what cytomegalic virus can do to the retina of an eye. And the poor man went on to die, but that's what he looked like at that stage while he had a play on Broadway. I mentioned that many of the conditions that we see are not what we saw before. Toxoplasmosis, as I say, is not a subtle condition in AIDS. It's a catastrophic problem. And we can, however, if you think of that early enough, you can do something about it. There are other conditions that we can't do anything about. And so very often the dilemma that faces a physician, a clinician, is to try to make a choice in a very difficult situation from a therapeutic point of view, what to do. And very often you don't have all the answers. It's not the easiest thing to do. A brain biopsy, you can stick a needle in, but sometimes you don't get out. And that is a CT scan that shows a large abscess there that anybody can see. And the thought of getting needles in and out of the patient's heads is not an easy thing when they're sick from every other cause. And so since we can do something about one of the conditions, very often we end up treating that condition, and we hope that we're doing some good. I put up this slide to just contrast the type of Kaposi sarcoma that had been seen in New York, where in the classical form, they were older people. They came largely in the United States, experienced from Middle Europe. There's a difference in the distribution, and yet under the microscope, this terrible tumor can look alike with the old one. And this is what it would look like in a young male with AIDS, the eruption of this tumor, which can go on and involve the lung and the brain and the intestinal tract and everything else. And again, this is a view into the intestinal tract where you see some of those tumors growing on the bowel. But as bad as that looks, the point I'm raising here is that most patients with this condition, because we can do something about it, still are alive a year later. So what they die of is one of many, many infections. And I think that is it. Has, as I tried to reflect in my talk, it seems to me a lot of implications that we can think about, just as in clinical medicine, we often have no answers, but it doesn't hurt us to think. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Well, we'll have questions now, please. Yes?
Okay, is this disease something that really just started, or just wasn't recognized until
Dr. Bourne's asked, if this seems stupid to you, but anyway, he's asked me that I repeat the questions because it goes on to a tape. So the question is, has this disease been around for a long, long time, or is it a new disease? And we're absolutely convinced it's a new disease. There are very, very good autopsy studies. In medicine, certainly in the last 100 years, even though we didn't have the answers to everything, they sure studied autopsies on a lot of patients, and this just was not there. So we are convinced this is a new condition. Yeah, I think it depends on the definition, and we've all struggled with the definition. It's terribly important that AIDS not be overdiagnosed and that people not be led to believe they have AIDS or inevitably going to go on to AIDS. I mentioned to the doctors at Vancouver yesterday a terrible episode that just happened in the last week. A patient of mine, his boyfriend jumped out a window because he had been told he had a pre-AIDS condition. And I think the first slide that I showed has to be borne in mind very carefully. You must have evidence of an immunological deficiency and evidence of one of the complications that I tried to show you briefly here before one makes a diagnosis of AIDS. I don't know the articles you referred to, but if it's anything similar to what I've seen, it would be confusing many people who've had exposure and may have, say, swollen lymph nodes. And I think it's also true as we get more experience, and this is only a 3-year experience, that we will recognize patients who may have, on the spectrum of any curve in medicine, some people are going to get very sick and go on and die, and some people are going to get well. We, in using our definition, if we make a diagnosis correctly of an AIDS patient, we haven't seen them get well yet.
The second part of the question was also broad, I didn't say broad, but not the same one. So they have been experimenting with implants, a little bit of thymus gland in AIDS patients, and they have at least temporarily renewed their immune system.
They've been, and this would really be impossible tonight, I can assure you, to get into the various therapies that have been tried or the experiments. I can only tell you that there is no evidence at this time that any one of the many, many things tried has had any lasting effect. The question is really, has antibiotics been incriminated as a cause of breaking down the immune system? And there are examples certainly of this, but it is not correlated with the AIDS experience. We don't think that previous antibiotic treatment in any way accounts for the many, many cases that we've seen, and in some patients that I have, I can assure you, they've not had any.
One more question then, because there are other people wishing to ask.
I don't know of any. I really don't know the answer to that. The question was, has there been any work on domestic animals? I didn't think chickens and cows were domestic, but that's where I'm from, New York, and so, but anyway, I don't know of any. I put a slide up. The question is, how many cases have there been in those who have no risk factors? And it's about 3% of the 2,300 cases. Now, it's also fair to say even on that, that some of those who have died without known risk factors have died before full questioning has been done. And we're not even certain that 3 to 4% is an accurate thing. It may be actually lower than that. I think that's an important point. I'm just going to make one other comment. Because of that very low percentage, I think with confidence we can certainly reassure health workers there's no evidence that AIDS is transmitted to health workers or to those people who are not at risk. By at risk we mean exposure either with intimate sexual contact or through blood transfusions or common needle sharing. And therefore, much of the fear and panic in the general community is totally unwarranted.
My question has to do with the social side of your address. Senator Kennedy has for years been attempting to advance socialized medicine in the United States. How far has he been progressing recently?
I don't know if I could agree with the first part of your statement. The question is, Senator Kennedy, or the statement at least, was that Senator Kennedy has been promoting socialized medicine in the United States, and how far has he progressed? I think Senator Kennedy is without question one of the more knowledgeable senators in our country on health. He was chairman of the Health Committee for the period of time that Mr. Carter was president, and he's now the ranking minority leader. He certainly has a deep interest in health, and I sound like I'm very prejudiced. I must say, when the AIDS book came out, Senator Kennedy held a reception for it in the Senate, which was almost unprecedented. And I know him very well, so I'm not without prejudice. I like him. So he's not going to succeed anyway. So if that's the point, I'll let Dr. Bourne direct. I don't want to.
We have a question from the left side now.
Yes, Dr. Dale, I look at, are patients necessarily kept in isolation in hospitals or elsewhere, such as at home, the one for the protection of the health workers, and two for their own protection, the one exposure to infection?
It's a very good question. Because of the question is, are patients kept in isolation for the protection of health workers or their own protection? Some forms of isolation are required in dealing with patients with AIDS, and those are no more than you have when you deal with a patient with hepatitis. Common sense says that if you have a disease that is transmitted through blood or secretions, you wear gloves if you're going to handle those objects if a person is dealing. But there is no need if a person does not have a respiratory complication of AIDS to wear gloves, to wear a mask in dealing with a Kaposi's patient. So that there are occasions, certainly, where a patient has a profound depression of their immune system, where we do ask people going in to see an AIDS patient to wear a mask and a gown. That's for the patient's protection. Very often, ignorance and fear make isolation a terrible added burden for the AIDS patient, and there's no justification for it. I don't know that we're ever going to correct it, because at least in our system at home, we have an AIDS patient on a floor. Other patients on the floor convince themselves that that terrible fellow at the end of the hall is a threat to their mother or whatever goes on, and they insist on the gown, and the nurses insist, and the hospital union insists. I think you deal in a society. We do our best to educate people that AIDS is not a highly contagious or transmittable disease if you don't have intimate sexual contact or needle transmission, as far as we know right now. So we try to minimize the amount of isolation that is imposed on these people because they already have enough problems.
Put here.
I don't know. There's not many female cases, and the ones that have been reported have been in the female partners of AIDS patients, particularly the drug addict or the Haitian. I'm not sure why the incidence is lower right now. It would seem to me that it probably has to do with sexual methodologies and not that they're that they're protected more, but there have been no cases that I know of up to this point. It would be pure speculation. I'm a clinician, and although I have many colleagues and stay in touch with the basic research people, I think it would be fair to say that most of us dealing or listening to would think that it is an infectious agent, and it seems most compatible with a virus, and there are a range of viruses that all of you read about in the newspaper that have been incriminated, from human T-cell leukemia virus to cytomegalic virus or variants thereof. And I have no answer on what it is. Yes, it's still growing at about the same rate. As I mentioned, I think that is likely to continue, even though there's been a marked change in the lifestyle of the at-risk populations because of the incubation period. That's likely to go up for a while. In those who, 2 years after diagnosis, the death rate is 80%, and very few of us have any that live longer than 3 years. Well, again, we're only starting, you know, in 1980, so we're getting out to our 3 years, but very few of us who saw the early cases have any around right now, and so most of the patients who have full-blown AIDS do die at the present time within 3 years. I've forgotten to follow Dr. Bourne's instructions of repeating the last six questions, but I'll repeat this one because it's a very good one. Question, and that is, has AIDS been known in concentration or refugee camps? And actually, one of the complications of AIDS from which people die, pneumocystis carinii, has been seen in both concentration camps and in refugee camps. And there are certain changes in the immunological system of people. But that has always followed prolonged and severe starvation, and this is not the same thing at all. This is seeing the sudden onset for no explicable reason. But one of the complications, at least, or more than that, tuberculosis would be very common in a refugee camp or concentration. So certain infections, pneumocystis classically, though.
The question from the back of the room.
Any speculations as to why the disease is now? Why not 5 years ago, or why not 5 years from now? What's the epidemiological factors that are looking at it specifically the problems now?
I don't, the question is, why has AIDS erupted now? And the answer is, we don't know. I don't know why it wasn't 5 years before, and I sure hope it's not here 5 years from now.
Yes. Are there any speculations for why some of the Asian population is here?
Yes, there is much speculation as to why the Haitian population has gotten AIDS, but it's very, very difficult to give a specific or an accurate answer to that. Some people contend that all of the Haitian patients that have come down with AIDS were homosexual, and that Haiti was a place that people who sought homosexual contact in the Caribbean could go readily. That doesn't seem to me to ring very true, because I would presume that if people want homosexual contact in Dominican Republic or some other island, they would have gone there. The Haitian population in both New York and Miami are largely isolated by culture, religion, and the fact that they're very many of them illegal aliens. And they have not been cooperative at all in questioning either on their sexual habits or really on anything else. So that there's been great effort to communicate with the Haitians, and not successfully, and there's not a great deal of successful communication with the government in Haiti at the present time. In fact, they deny there's any AIDS, so.
Dr. Warren?
In the Science, about 3 weeks ago, there were two articles on immune deficiencies caused by trace element deficiencies. Is this an issue?
The question is whether immune deficiency secondary to trace elements might be a cause of AIDS. I don't know the answer to it. I know of no evidence for it right now. It would seem unlikely to me because many of these young men in particular were certainly very, very healthy. I mean, as many people in the gay community, they are very deep into exercise and gymnasium. The Haitian worker patients that I've seen have been very healthy. So I know no evidence of that, doctor. Now, the question is AIDS limited to the Western Hemisphere? And the answer is no. Increasingly, there have been cases reported from, I think it's now 17 countries that have been reporting it, with the centers apparently associated with places where there are large homosexual communities. For example, Denmark, Berlin, Paris, London, Japan, has had a number. It's almost sad to say, and it's a terrible reflection on New York, but I had a patient of mine who has AIDS, and he was a gatekeeper, a man who sat at the desk at one of the local bathhouses. And he told me a year or 2 years ago that in the gay community in New York, there was an awareness something terrible was going on, and the people stopped going to the baths. But Japanese tourists by the thousands were still coming in because there are books that tell you where you can go if you want to have a holiday in New York and you want to meet other gay people. And so they would go. And I think this is, the bath stayed open and they served another population. I think, without any question, it's spreading around and it's going to be recognized around. I don't know what the World Health Organization is doing.
Yes. How do you arrive at the
indication period? I have a patient I mentioned at the Vancouver conference yesterday that had a single homosexual relationship for the last 17 years, with one exception, and that was a holiday in Haiti 5 years ago, during which time he had something like 60 sexual contacts during a week. If that is true, then the incubation period may be that long. But there is one 18-month is the figure used of a patient on blood transfusion where the blood was donated by an AIDS victim who eventually came down. And that's a fairly well-worked-out case that the patient did not develop AIDS for 18 months after he had donated the blood, and the person who had received the blood developed AIDS. So that's how it's worked out. It's going to be more observation. Again, I'd like you to just remember these, as I mentioned in my talk, this syndrome, and it's not a specific disease, was recognized first only 3 years ago, and I don't want to act in any way as terribly wise up here. We all stumbled around at first. We'd see one case, you'd see a second, you didn't call your car, and then suddenly the cases began to build up. And if you even remember some of those slides, I say 1980, but it was really by 81 that the cases began. So we're awfully early in the history of this disease. In the United States, the question is, what are they doing about screening blood donations? And the answer is a very important one to realize. In the millions and millions of blood units that are given every year, there have been very, very few, in fact, only four cases that have been seriously associated with AIDS. And in the United States, they now offer people coming into the voluntary clinics, and most hospitals will only use blood donated by volunteers now. We no longer use purchased blood, so that which has a much higher incidence of complications in every way. And in the volunteer blood banks or in the blood drives, in order not to embarrass anyone, so that if a blood bank comes up to the IBM company and everybody goes out to give blood, so that somebody not be embarrassed, there is a form that everyone must fill out now. Are you homosexual? Have you had many contacts? Have you had unexplained fever, weight loss, diarrhea? And then asks, would you prefer your blood to be used for research as opposed for transfusion? The New York Blood Bank then did a large series for a number of months checking these bloods against everything that we have know about, at least Epstein-Barr, cytomegalic, hepatitis, everything you can think of. The cooperation rate is, I think, enormously good. And a lot of this has been promoted by groups like the Gay Men's Health Crisis. So I think there's absolute safety in, nothing's absolute in this world. I think there's safety in getting blood, and I think doctors and families are aware of the potential danger, but I think the blood banks have done a wonderful job with the cooperation of the at-risk communities in trying to resolve this. I think all of us in clinical medicine are aware you don't, probably a little more aware than we used to be, you don't give blood if you don't really have to give blood, if you don't have to give two units and you were going to give, you probably don't. But I don't think there should be any concern among people. If you need blood and the judgment of your physician is that you need it, the balance, I mean, statistically, it would be enormously in anyone's favor. And certainly there's no evidence, which was a rumor going around New York, people stopped donating blood because they were concerned that they would get AIDS from donating. I mean, that's ridiculous. So keep donating, and if you need it, God willing, your doctor will tell you.
There was a hand up at the back there.
Yes, I was wondering about the use of bone marrow transplant.
Most of the patients, it has not been successfully tried. It's been thought about. Most of the patients are so overwhelmingly ill that it has not been a feasible thing to do at this time.
Yes? Butterfield?
Yes? Has anyone studied the possibility that mutation at some point might be the cause?
Mutation of what? Of the in other words, many people believe that a virus, say, if that is the cause, that the virus has mutated. Is that the question? Yes, I think that is one of the very, very strong possibilities. Either a specific virus that's not been recognized, a virus that was there and has mutated, or what is called the multifactorial theory that many different types of abuse just overwhelm the person's immune system, and then a virus that had been previously of no consequence to the person becomes fatal. I think it's all speculation now.
Yes.
With respect to blood donors, is it possible that the blood might be in a the donor might be in a state of incubation? We don't know. Have you checked the blood itself?
No, as I mentioned, we don't have a specific diagnosis for this disease at this time, and so there is no way at the present, and the one case that we discussed was during, obviously, the patient's incubation. There's one, there are always reprehensible cases, just as there are people, an AIDS victim certainly has a moral, it would seem, obligation not to go out and have sexual relations with someone else, but I have a patient who has been doing it continuously out of some sort of anger against the world and everything else. And there's one case that just came up of a person who has donated repetitively over the last year in paid blood banks, And I'm sure that there might be a sick individual out there. This really isn't, hasn't been a major factor. That's all I can say.
Yes?
Yes. Yes, I think that's the question is, is there a great deal of concern in the dental profession? And I think we've all forgotten the dentists, and we shouldn't, because they really do have their hands in the mouths of patients all the time, are very exposed to small amounts of blood. And I think it behooves any dentist or any dental hygienist, and certainly if I, as a physician, have a patient who's going to a dentist, it's my responsibility to say that this patient has a disease which you should wear gloves. So I think it is going to be a problem to the dental profession, and they'll have to learn to deal with it.
You mentioned that the average age of age victim was 35. What was the youngest age you had?
Judging from my practice, I take care of only adults. So I saw it on Canadian television, the 14-day-old baby of the Haitian mother who had AIDS. So there are pediatric cases. I think all of us are influenced by the type of practice. I don't tend to see as many drug addicts as somebody who practices up in the South Bronx might see, or I don't see as many Haitians as someone in Brooklyn. I tend to see the young, modestly, the dress designer, the decorator, the actor, the playwright, the person there. So I can only tell you my case is around 35, and they low 20s, teens, in the homosexual group, that is.
Any further questions?
I guess so.
I'll now call on Professor, or at least Dr. John Dirks, the Professor of Medicine, to express our thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, medicine is never static. Throughout history, new infectious diseases have come forth, been virulent, and then either subsided in their virulence or had the identification of their cause and hopefully the development of their treatment. AIDS is such a new disease, and just judging by the seriousness of the questions, this indeed is an issue of great public interest. I think we're all grateful to Dr. Kahle for taking a complex and difficult subject and dealing with it with sensitivity and compassion, a sensitivity that I believe is generated from the fact that he's encountered and seen those who are afflicted with this problem. I think in dealing with the issue in a deliberately non-emotional way, in taking it as a dispassionate issue, he has served the issue indeed very well. It is only by such dispassionate discussion that we indeed will arrive at some knowledge about the cause and arrive at a solution for this presumably infectious problem. I would like to ask you to join with me in expressing gratitude to Dr. Kahle for an excellent and eloquent presentation.